Accept number 8192, number 2.
Brigadier Barclay, Reel 2. I think you were explaining that your main means of communication was by line.
This was very vulnerable, obviously. We had an 18 cert, if I remember right, which theoretically gave companies contact with battalion headquarters, but they were very unreliable. And frequently, I recall, the only way of maintaining communications was by runner.
Did you have any dispatch riders attached to you?
If one had an isolated role, such as being an outpost company, or on some detachment job, nearly always a company commander would be allocated a dispatch rider.
Presumably he would have come from headquarters company.
Yes, that's right.
Now, you mentioned that you'd intensified training while you were at Gibraltar, after your commanding officer had decided that a war was in prospect. Had you concentrated on any particular aspect?
No, because one was very limited in Gibraltar. There was no scope for any form of tactical training. It had to be done on an individual training basis, perfecting standards of marksmanship and introduction of everybody to any new weapon developments, and a great deal of theory. It was on the subject of cloth model exercises and lectures that we were able only to portray and study the tactical picture.
Did you use cloth models for the other ranks as well?
Oh yes. We used cloth models a lot. I must say I'm a great believer in cloth models and sand tables. And during the war I used them always, the entire time. I briefed everybody, down to the last year, private soldier, on cloth models. As a company commander, brief first the platoon commanders, then the platoons in turn would brief their platoons on a cloth model. I think the more soldiers are in the picture and are taken into your confidence about what's going to happen and how it's going to happen, the better they react.
Was that a general regimental traditional policy that soldiers were to be told as much as possible?
I think it became more and more so, very much. I mean, a great deal more of this happened after the D-Day part of the war than happened in the early stages of the war.
So earlier on it was a personal...
Yes, I would say that.
Had you done a lot of training for gas warfare?
Oh yes, we did. We were all thoroughly anti-gas trained. And of course we had to carry our gas mask with us absolutely everywhere before we went overseas.
Had you done range work in gas masks?
Yes, we had. We fired our weapons in gas masks.
Did wearing a gas mask have any appreciable effect on accuracy?
I think it must have a bit, but we chaps wore them so often that they got used to them, and then we had good anti-dim mixtures for keeping the eyepieces clear, and certain practices had to be fought, had to be fired with gas masks on. So they were very used to it, and it didn't worry them beyond reason.
What was the state of morale like?
Very good indeed. Very good indeed. It was very refreshing altogether. It was splendid.
And discipline?
Very strict. Our commanding officer was a very strict disciplinarian, and the battalion was all the better for it.
Were there any prevalent offences which occurred as a matter of routine?
No, I think the type of person we had in our battalion is not the least bit prone to getting into trouble. And we had remarkably little crime of any sort. Just occasionally, cases of drunkenness, and that was about all I can think of.
How did you actually run your company? How did you control it?
I controlled it by very direct contact. And I knew the men individually jolly well, and I knew their family backgrounds well, and I knew which of them were married and this sort of thing. And I think they appreciated the fact that one had taken the trouble to find this out, and they used to come along with any sort of family problems they'd got. I think this helped, too, obviously, to weld the company into a close-knit team, which it undoubtedly was. One did a certain amount, obviously through one's platoon commanders, but I thought it was extremely important for a company commander to know all his chaps individually and his sort of background setup. And I thought a lot of games too. Team spirit is built up to a very large extent on games playing and the team work that's necessary in so many games. And we used to play games whenever we had a possible opportunity. And we had a jolly good athletic team in the company, and we had a jolly good football team, and we had a good cricket team. And there were very few members of the company that weren't involved in some form of activity or another. I mean, athletics did come in a great number as well. But this all helped to stimulate morale. There's no doubt about that at all.
Was any particular sport better than any other for this sort of thing?
Football was obviously one sport which they probably enjoyed the best, but we always had a very good athletic team and a very good old cross-country running team. Cross-country running was always done as a team, and they all minded terribly about not letting the side down from any weakness on their part.
Do you think that cross-country running helped them to appreciate ground?
Oh, I do. Oh, I do. I very much so. Very much so. I used to take them out a great deal, and map reading I used to do on a very small level. So that if chaps got cut off or anything, they got a sporting chance of understanding a map and finding their way back.
Roughly how much of the training within the company was done at on company schemes as opposed to platoon schemes?
I think about two-thirds on a platoon level, because you've got the sections in the platoon. Each section's got to function as an entity. You've got the group of the sections within the platoon. That's got to function as an entity. And you had a company with three or it was four platoons. That's got to function as an entity. But the most important subunit of the whole lot is the platoon. And the platoons are the type of formation one use for a big patrol. It's the lowest formation, which is commanded by an officer. And if you've got good platoons in a battalion, you've got a good battalion.
So the platoon level is the critical level?
Yes. Therefore, the section of a platoon commander was of particular importance. Mark, if you've got a lousy company commander, that didn't help, but we weren't accustomed to that sort of picture at all.
When you had to make a decision about a training scheme or designing an exercise or something like that, how did you go about doing it?
Well, one would have a pattern of types of exercise one wanted to concentrate on at any one time, whether it was attack or defence or whether it was withdrawal or whatever. And one would exercise on the platoon level at that particular subject, and then one would exercise on the battalion level, and then after that on a company level, and then after that on a battalion level. But when you got up to that stage, one generally had a comprehensive exercise where one or more aspects of warfare would be incorporated.
But when you were actually making a decision about what the company was going to do for a particular exercise and so on, did you make the decision entirely on your own, or did you consult your platoon commanders before deciding
would have a directive from battalion headquarters, which gave a guideline as to the type of exercise or the type of encounter that or engagement that was wanted to be practiced. And then as a company commander, I would make an embryo plan and then discuss it with my platoon commanders before actually we carried it out. There wasn't much, it was a one-way discussion, I'll tell you that, but I'd be open to any good suggestions.
Well, I mean, if you were open to suggestions, it wasn't entirely one way.
No, that's true. That's true. But one accepted suggestions within limits, within bounds.
But there was some element of consultation downwards.
Yes, but it wasn't a Soviet. I mean, one knew what one wanted to achieve, roughly how one was going to achieve it. But if they had helpful suggestions on ways and means of perfecting the achievement thereof, well, well, good.
Stop me. Did you have any senior visitors while you were doing your final training?
Yes, we did. We were very much in the limelight, and senior officers used to appear at practically every exercise that we did. And during the last exercise, I remember my company had just captured its objective in a battalion battle at Borden, and I was conscious of a bit of a gathering behind my company headquarters, and I turned around, there's the King, Queen of England, without the slightest warning whatsoever. So I, in fact, was sitting on the side of my slip trench, which had just been dug for me, with a company commander of the supporting company behind me, as I say, enjoying a bottle of beer, and there was the monarch. So we thought, well, the best thing was to give him one or two. So we sat on the edge of the trench, enjoying our beer, a very hot day, and he congratulated the company on the élan, was the word he used, with which they had captured their objective, and how impressed that he and the Queen had been watching us, which they had been doing during the whole course of proceedings.
How did the men take to that?
Oh, they were thrilled. They were absolutely thrilled, and it was such a surprise. And I just told them that the commanding officers had it right in the way that they had carried out this attack, and then suddenly one got it from the monarch. So they had their tails right up.
Were they overawed by his...
No, no, they weren't a bit. They reacted splendidly and answered any questions that the monarch put to them, and they were most elusive, most lucid.
And was he good at talking to soldiers?
To start with, he was a bit shy, but then when they responded, he warmed up to it. Everybody got on fine.
You said you were always plagued by generals coming down. Can you remember any other generals specifically who visited you in Borden?
Well, I know General Dill, for whom we had very high regard, came to see us, and also General Gort appeared one day. We were obviously very much in the public eye at this stage.
You mentioned you've been practicing an attack. Was this attack upon a fortified position?
Elements of an enemy force occupying a pretty strategic position in the rough country near Borden. And we just carried out an attack against this position without using live ammunition.
How did you actually go about making an attack at company level? What were the basic principles on which you would develop an attack?
Well, the first thing is to smother the opposition as much as you possibly can with effective fire. Now, when you've got to demoralise the enemy to contend with, you're going to capture objective a lot quicker and with a lot less loss. So the first principle, I always reckon, was to shatter their morale with fire. It needn't be all that dead accurate. The noise is generally enough to cow the most brazen adversary. So once you've done that, always ensure that you've got an element giving covering fire of the infantry when there's an element advancing until you get right up to the assault distance from the position, and then the leading two platoons on the company level go bashing on in together. But the longer you can keep your fire going until the moment the attacking forces reach the ground of the objective, the more likely you are to succeed, and succeed without heavy loss.
You say that the two forward platoons would rush in on the position eventually to clear it. Would that be from the front, or was it a principle to always come in from the flank?
Well, one can't give a rule of thumb about that. It depended on the lie of the land to a great extent, and how you visualised the pattern of the defences. Obviously, the less obvious the manner of your attack, and the higher degree you could achieve any form of surprise, the more likely your success with the minimum of loss.
From what you've been saying, it sounds as though your idea is that it's the psychological aspects that are really of critical importance rather than the purely physical.
Well, I learnt this in the war, I must say, the theory of it, what it had instilled into one to a minor extent, but the psychological effect of fire turned out in the war to be infinitely more effective and create a greater impact by far than I had anticipated. Particularly when you get firing in woods or in trees, it increases the volume of the horror enormously.
Because of the secondary missiles.
Yeah.
You said earlier on, I think, that you've done one exercise with tanks. Was that at Borden?
Yes. I can't remember the details of it. And it wasn't one when live firing took place. Nor do I remember the type of tanks, I'm afraid.
Did you ever do any tactical exercises with artillery giving support?
No. We didn't, nor with aircraft giving support, and of course one never did any of these sort of exercises with live ammunition in those days.
You did no live firing at all?
No.
When you eventually moved to the continent, how was that journey carried out?
We went by train to Southampton, and then it was a troop ship or a requisition transport, I can't remember, to Cherbourg. And then we went to Le Mans, and there we were confronted by a complete anticlimax. We were bristling to go, and instead of that, we hung around in Le Mans for about a fortnight. No enemy air opposition, let alone ground opposition. And finally, before long, we were helping farmers with their harvest, waiting for next stage of proceedings. And from Le Mans, we then were transported up to what became known as the Gaunt Line.
Do you remember if your journey across the Channel was in a convoy or whether your ship sailed on its own?
I can't remember. I honestly can't remember.
But it was an uneventful journey.
Totally uneventful.
Mm. What was your first impression of Cherbourg then?
Well, everything was very efficiently organised. We arrived there, and we were goofed at by the French to quite an extent, and cheered on by the French. And then we bussed and moved to Le Mans, which didn't seem to take very long. And there we were billeted, waiting for the next stage of proceedings.
Had you been to France before?
Yes.
French?
A little bit. I've been several times.
How did you get on with the...
Well, I think we were treated with a certain amount of mistrust to start with. I know a good friend of mine and I were, as far as our billet was concerned, we were parked on Monsieur Le Abbé. But he, duty-bound, had to shows a degree of hospitality, which improved enormously as the days went by. And I think when they began to realise we were there to help them in the main, and then also when we helped them with getting their crops in, we left a very friendly population in the vicinity.
Did you do any military training while you were
in Le Mans? No, we didn't. I can't think why, but we didn't. I think It wasn't known when we were going to be called forward, and therefore we couldn't go out doing exercise. You did a certain amount of individual training, very small group training, but no collective training.
When you moved to Le Mans in motor transport, was it service call?
I can't remember. I'm afraid I can't remember.
Did you move in an organised convoy?
Yes, an organised convoy. We were very conscious of the likelihood of being attacked from the air. But it never came. We never saw a German airplane at all.
What precautions could you take against that sort of attack?
Well, we had a man per lorry with a machine gun mounted on a tripod. And most of these vehicles had a circle cut in the roof where the chap could take up his position.
What sort of distance did you have between vehicles?
I think about 30, 40 yards.
How was the convoy controlled?
I can't remember. All I do remember is that it went very smoothly and there wasn't a hitch. And there were dispatch rises at all the turnings where a vehicle might have gone wrong.
Were they men from your battalion?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
You didn't see any military police?
Yes, there were some of them as well.
Were there any buildings or tents or anything else that had been put up to accommodate troops at Le Mans, or were you just bunged into civilian houses?
I think we were all billeted. Of course, bombs took a lot of people. And there was no shortage of them, or stored a bed down on.
What about the supply of food and drink? Did that...
Well, we had our rations, which were good but boring. And this, of course, while we were at Le Mans, was supplemented quite a bit by fresh foodstuffs we got from the locals.
What did the soldiers think of the French food and drink?
Oh, they're terribly conservative, of course. The beer wasn't the right sort of beer, and the French cooking, by and large, was too oily or whatever. They really took a long time to get used to anything other than their customary victuals.
So they didn't take drinking wine?
No, they didn't touch that. Didn't take to that at all kindly. Calvados occasionally, if they're feeling flush.
What about coffee? Did they drink
coffee? Oh, yes, they drank quite a bit of that. They realise that French coffee was generally, by and large, a different brew to what they were used to in England.
You say that initially the French at Le Mans showed a certain amount of suspicion towards you. How did that show itself?
Reserve. I couldn't describe it no how else. I wouldn't say they were suspicious so much as they were reserved. And then when they realised we were prepared to cooperate and help them as much as possible, it changed the atmosphere quite a lot. Of course, the private soldier is a marvellous person to get on with people. And in no time at all, they were chatting up the kids and making themselves thoroughly welcome.
Do you think that bringing in the harvest, doing the farm work, was the critical?
No, I don't think it was. I think the general attitude of the soldiers was the most critical thing.
Do you remember having any discussions on the war in general terms with the Abbé on whom you were billeted?
Oh yes, we did. He thought the whole thing would be over in a month or two. And to start off with, why would he got to be saddled with a British air when the French army is perfectly capable of coping? He didn't know. But
How did he think it was going to be finished?
Well, he just thought that once the Germans hit the Maginot Line, which he thought existed from north to south, they would just crumple up and be shattered to pieces by these marvellous fire plan organisation that everybody knew that the Maginot Line was capable of. Everybody in France had this attitude of on ne passe pas, and this was a cry. This was the keynote of their military attitude, Everybody used to wear little badges, on a passeport, on a passeport. No sort of thrusting forward, no offensive attitude. Sit back and just wait and then let them have it when they reach the Maginot Line. That was a general feeling throughout the country.
Let the technology do the work.
Yeah, absolutely.
How old do you think this man was, this Abbé?
Oh, I think he was about 45.
So he would have lived through the First World War.
Yes, he must have had. He must have seen some of that. Yes.
But he was quite friendly, was he, towards the end?
Oh yes, towards the end. We were great friends. He produced the most marvellous old vintage bottle of Calvados the night before we left, which really showed what his feelings were like by the time we'd been with him for a fortnight.
And I think then you were saying that you moved up to the frontier. How did you make that move?
Now, the details of it I can't remember, but we went by bus and military transport of a sort. And it was trouble-free. I can't remember how long we took getting there, but there was no hitch at all. And then we arrived in the neighbourhood of a little village called Rumigy, on the frontier between France and Belgium.
And what did you do once you'd arrived there?
We were on the right of the whole of the British line. In fact, my company was the right-hand company of the British line. And I had the French on my right. And our job was to prepare defences along the line of a little stream which ran north, west, south, east, through the other way around, northeast, south, east, north, west, close to Rumigy. And extraordinarily, we were just required to create these defensive positions absolutely bang on the line, this little stream, which in some cases meant that there was practically no field of fire at all. And so we had to build the most extraordinary positions. Now, some of my platoon section positions were breastworks, and some even were built in trees to raise them off the ground sufficiently to give a field of fire, with, of course, enormous bowstring underneath. But totally impractical. But that's what we were ordered to do. And rather than drop back and take up a reverse slope position, we had to defend the frontier, presumably, because this ditch, this stream, did provide, in most places, an anti-tank obstacle.
You say you had some posts in the trees. Were they actually firing points, or were they...
Oh, yes, they were...